Dennis wondered why he had never Gage's embrace and turned round to shepherd his little flock. They made their way along the side of the house to the entrance of the yew tree walk that led down to the lower garden. Between the blank, precipitous wall of the house and the tall yew trees, the path was a chasm of impenetrable gloom. Somewhere there were steps down to the right, a gap in the yew hedge. Dennis, who headed the party, groped his way cautiously. In this darkness, one had an irrational fear of yawning precipices, of horrible spiked obstructions. Suddenly, from behind him, he heard a shrill, startled "Oh!" and then a sharp, dry concussion that might have been the sound of a slap. After that, Jenny's voice was heard pronouncing, "I'm going back to the house." Her tone was decided, and even as she pronounced the words, she was melting away into the darkness. The incident, whatever it had been, was closed. Dennis resumed his forward groping. From somewhere behind, Ivor began to sing again, softly. "Felice, plus ever que tendre ne gagnant rien à refuser, un jour exigia si vendre ton mouton pour un baiser." The melody dropped and climbed again with a kind of easy languor. The warm darkness seemed to pulse like blood about them. "Le lendemain il va le faire pour le berger le trop fou bon." "Here are the steps," cried Dennis. He guided his companions over the danger, and in a moment they had the turf of the yew tree walk under their feet. It was lighter here, or at least it was just perceptibly less dark, for the yew walk was wider than the path that had led them under the lee of the house. Looking up, they could see between the high black hedges a strip of sky and a few stars. "Carry l'altin de la Bavière," went on Ivor, and then interrupted himself to shout, "I'm going to run down," and he was off, full speed, down the invisible slope, singing unevenly as he went, "Ton baiser pour un mouton." The others followed. Dennis shambled in the rear, vainly exhorting everyone to caution. The slope was steep, one might break one's neck. What was wrong with these people, he wondered. They had become like young kittens after a dose of catnip. He himself felt a certain kittenishness sporting within him, but it was, like all his emotions, rather a theoretical feeling. It did not overmasteringly seek to express itself in a practical demonstration of kittenishness. "Be careful," he shouted once more, and hardly were the words out of his mouth when, thump, was the sound of a heavy fall in front of him, followed by the long of a breath indrawn with pain, and afterwards by a very sincere "Ooh!" Dennis was almost pleased. He had told them so, the idiots, and they wouldn't listen. He trotted down the slope towards the unseen sufferer. Mary came down the hill like a runaway steam engine. It was tremendously exciting, this blind rush through the dark. She felt she would never stop. But the ground grew level beneath her feet, her speed insensibly slackened, and so extended arm and brought to an abrupt halt. "Well," said Ivor as he tightened his embrace, "you're caught now, Anne." She made an effort to release herself. "It's not Anne, it's Mary." Ivor burst into a peal of amused laughter. "So it is," he exclaimed. "I seem to be making nothing but floaters this evening. I've already made them with Jenny." He laughed again, and there was something so jolly about his laughter that Mary could not help laughing too. He did not remove his encircling arm, and somehow it was all so amusing and natural that Mary made no further attempt to escape from it. They walked along by the side of the pool, interlaced. Mary was too short for him to be able, with any comfort, to lay his head on her shoulder. He rubbed his cheek, caressed and caressing against the thick, sleek mass of her hair. In a little while, he began to sing again. The knights trembled amorously to the sound of his voice. When he had finished, he kissed her. Anne or Mary, Mary or Anne, it didn't seem to make much difference which it was. There were differences in detail, of course, but the general effect was the same, and, after all, the general effect was the important thing. Dennis made his way down the hill. "Any damage done?" he called out. "Is that you, Dennis? I've hurt my ankle so, and my knee, and my hand. I'm all in pieces." "My poor Anne," he said. But then, he couldn't help adding, "it was silly to start running downhill in the dark." "Ass," she retorted, in the tone of tearful irritation. "Of course it was." He sat down beside her on the grass and found himself breathing the faint, delicious atmosphere of perfume that she carried always with her. "Light a match," she commanded. "I want to look at my wounds." He felt in his pockets for the matchbox. The light spurted and then grew steady. Magically, a little universe had been created, a world of colors and forms. Anne's face, the shimmering orange of her dress, her white, bare arms, a patch of green turf, and round about a darkness that had become solid and utterly blind. Anne held out her hands. Both were green and earthy with her fall, and the left exhibited two or three red abrasions. "Not so bad," she said, but Dennis was terribly distressed, and his emotion was intensified when, looking up at her face, he saw that the trace of tears, involuntary tears of pain, lingered on her eyelashes. He pulled out his handkerchief and began to wipe away the dirt from the wounded hand. The match went out. It was not worthwhile to light another. Anne allowed herself to be attended to meekly and gratefully. "Thank you," she said, when he'd finished cleaning and bandaging her hand. And there was something in her tone that made him feel that she had lost her superiority over him, that she was younger than he, had become suddenly almost a child. He felt tremendously large and protective. The feeling was so strong that instinctively he put his arm about her. She drew closer, leaned against him, and so they sat in silence. Then, from below, soft but wonderfully clear through the still darkness, the they heard the sound of Ivor singing. He was going on with his half-finished song. Les lendemains finissent plus tendre, ni le long du clair au berger, fut trop heureuse de lui rendre ton mouton pour un baiser. There was a rather prolonged pause. It was as though time were being allowed for the giving and receiving of a few of those 30 kisses. Then the voice sang on. Les lendemains finissent plus sages, auraient ton mouton et chien, pour un baiser que le velage palisait donné pour rien. The last note died away into an uninterrupted silence. Are you better? Dennis whispered. Are you comfortable like this? She nodded a yes to both questions. Ton mouton pour un baiser, the sheep, the woolly mutton, bah, or the shepherd. Yes, decidedly, he felt himself to be the shepherd now. He was the master, the protector. A wave of courage swirled through him, warm as wine. He turned his head and began to kiss her face, at first rather randomly, then with more precision on the mouth. Anne averted her head. He kissed the ear, the smooth nape that his movements presented to him. No, she protested. No, Dennis. Why not? It spoils our friendship, and that was so jolly. Bosh, said Dennis. She tried to explain. Can't you see, she said, it isn't our stunt at all. It was true. Somehow she had never thought of Dennis in the light of a man who might make love. She'd never so much as conceived the possibilities of an amorous relationship with him. He was so absurdly young, so, she couldn't find the adjective, but she knew what she meant. Why isn't it our stunt, asked Dennis, and by the way, that's a horrible and inappropriate expression. Because it isn't. But if I say it is, it makes no difference. I say it isn't. That should make you say it is. All right, Dennis, but you must do it another time. I must go in and get my ankle into hot water. It's beginning to swell. Reasons of health could not be gainsaid. Dennis got up reluctantly and helped his companion to her feet. She took a cautious step. Ooh, she halted and leaned heavily on his arm. I'll carry you, Dennis offered. He had never tried to carry a woman, but on the cinema it always looked an easy piece of heroism. You couldn't, said Anne. Of course I can. He felt larger and more protective than ever. Put your arms round my neck, he ordered. She did so, and, stooping, he picked her up under the knees and lifted her from the ground. Good heavens, what a weight! He took 5 staggering steps up the slope, then almost lost his equilibrium and had to deposit his burden suddenly with something of a bump. Anne was shaking with laughter. I said you couldn't, my poor Dennis. I can, said Dennis without conviction. I'll try again. It's perfectly sweet of you to offer, but I'd rather walk, thanks. She laid her hand on his shoulder and, thus supported, began to limp slowly up the hill. seems incredible, but only 2 minutes ago, he should have been holding her in his embrace, kissing her. Incredible. She was helpless then, a child. Now, she had regained all her superiority. She was once more the far-off being, desired and unassailable. Why had he been such a fool as to suggest that carrying stunt? He reached the house in a state of the profoundest depression. He helped Anne upstairs, left her in the hands of a maid, and came down again into the drawing room. He was surprised to find them all sitting just where he had left them. He had expected that, somehow, everything would be quite different. It seemed such a prodigious time since he went away. All silent and all damned, he reflected as he looked at them. Mr. Scobie's pipe still wheezed. That was the only sound. Henry Wimbush was still deep in his account books. He had just made the discovery that Sir Ferdinando was in the habit of eating oysters the whole summer through, regardless of the absence of the justifying R. Gombauld in horn-rimmed spectacles was reading. Jenny was mysteriously scribbling in her red notebook. And, seated in her favourite armchair at the corner of the hearth, Priscilla was looking through a pile of drawings. One by one she held them out at arm's length and, throwing back her mountainous orange head, looked long and attentively through half-closed eyelids. She wore a pale sea-green dress. On the slope of her mauve-powdered décolletage, diamonds twinkled. An immensely long cigarette holder projected at an angle from her face. Diamonds were embedded in her high-piled coiffure. They glittered every time she moved. It was a batch of Ivor's drawings, sketches of spirit life made in the course of tranced tours through the other world. On the back of each sheet, descriptive titles were written. Portrait of an Angel, 15th of March, 20. Astral Beings at Play, 3rd of December, 19. A Party of Souls on Their Way to a Higher Sphere, 21st of May, 21. Before examining the drawings on the obverse of each sheet, she turned it over to read the title. Try as she could, and she tried hard. Priscilla had never seen a vision or succeeded in establishing any communication with the spirit world. She had to be content with the reported experiences of others. "What have you done with the rest of your party?" she asked, looking up as Dennis entered the room. He explained. Anne had gone to bed. Ivor and Mary were still in the garden. He selected a book and a comfortable chair and tried, as far as the disturbed state of his mind would permit him, to compose himself for an evening reading. The lamplight was utterly serene. There was no movement, save the stir of Priscilla among her papers. "All silent and all damned," Dennis repeated to himself. "All silent and all damned." It was nearly an hour later when Ivor and Mary made their appearance. We wait to see the moon rise, said Arthur. It was gibberish, you know, Mary explained, very technical and scientific. It was so beautiful down in the garden, the trees, the scent of the flowers, the stars. Ivor waved his arms, and when the moon came up, it was really too much. It made me burst into tears. He sat down at the piano and opened the lid. There were a great many meteorites, said Mary to anyone who would listen. The earth must just be coming into the summer shower of them in July and August. But Ivor had already begun to strike the keys. He played the garden, the stars, the scent of the flowers, the rising moon. He even put in a nightingale that was not there. Mary looked on and listened with parted lips. The others pursued their occupations without appearing to be seriously disturbed. On this very July day, exactly 350 years ago, Sir Ferdinando had eaten 7 dozen oysters. The discovery of this fact gave Henry Wimbush a peculiar pleasure. He had a natural piety which made him delight in the celebration of memorial feasts. 350th anniversary of the 7 dozen oysters. He wished then before dinner he would have ordered champagne. On her way to bed, Mary paid a call. The light was out in Anne's room, but she was not yet asleep. Why didn't you come down to the garden with us? Mary asked. I fell down and twisted my ankle. Dennis helped me home. Mary was full of sympathy. Inwardly, too, she was relieved to find Anne's non-appearance so simply accounted for. She had been vaguely suspicious down there in the garden, suspicious of what she hardly knew, but there had seemed to be something a little louche in the way she had suddenly found herself alone with Ivor. Not that she minded, of course, far from it, but she didn't like the idea that perhaps she was the victim of a put-up job. I do hope you'll be better tomorrow, she said, and she commiserated with Anne on all she had missed. The garden, the stars, the scent of the flowers, the meteorites, through whose summer shower the earth was now passing, the rising moon and its gibbosity. And then they had such interesting conversation. What about? About almost everything, nature, art, science, poetry, the stars, spiritualism, the relations of the sexes, music, religion. Ivor, she thought,